Well, that was a really rich and fantastic set of papers and talks, and there's a lot to talk about. So I'm just going to open up the floor now, give us a chance to discuss, and we can, people can ask questions, make comments, you can address to one, the whole panel, as you will.
Thank you. It's really about whether your research covered kids from ethnic minority backgrounds in poor inner city schools, for example, such as the one my son goes to, where I see such a huge emphasis on branding and this shopping generation that you talked about, that seems sort of crippling and soul destroying, and whereas you offered something a bit more promising than that. And the other point about children and stress, I'm just wondering whether this is a new thing or whether it's been going on for a very long time, but it's only recently that it's been looked at and articulated, because I think childhood stress has been going on for a very, very long time. So just two questions.
Do you want to collect a few for everybody?
Okay, yeah, why don't we take three, and then, and if people want to identify themselves, that would be great. Great, thanks. Any other?
Kirsty Hobson, the University of Oxford. Sorry, bit of a frog in my throat. My question is also for Bronwyn. Thank you very much for your paper. That was both enlightening and moving at the same time. And I really agree with the point you made about not turning our children into, you know, Boy Scouts and Girl Guides in terms of the environment, that we're depoliticizing what it actually takes to think about it. And you said we don't need to change them, we need to listen. And I was trying to think as you were talking what that would actually look like. So I just wanted to push you a bit more on that point and ask you what you think us listening actually looks like and entails.
And one more. Did you have a question down here? Or it's been answered?
Thanks. Kevin Birchall at Kingston University. Sorry, guys. Bronwyn. You know, it's always hugely enjoyable listening to your talks, and at the same time having the rug pulled out from, you know, the work that I'm doing. You know, but it is enjoyable. But you know, I wanted to perhaps return again to, you know, I feel that it's perhaps a little bit unhelpful to, you know, characterize some of these things as, you know, Boy Scouts and Girl Guides with, you know, negative connotations. I'm working with school children at the moment on energy in their school and at home. And certainly the work that we're doing, you know, if you do it the right way, then it builds the agency of the children. You know, they can change things. They can start to change things in their homes. But I'm hoping that, you know, this will also give them, you know, ambition to change things outside of their homes as well. And I feel that you've got to start somewhere with that. So it's just a kind of a riposte to that theme of the debate.
Great. So why don't we let Bronwyn answer those, and then if any of the other panelists have comments on
this.
Thank
you.
Questions.
If I just answered them as a group, because they fit well, and thank you. I didn't talk about the work that we've been doing with children aged sort of 8 to 12, and from a range of different ethnic backgrounds, and especially this is how the project started really, is following kids growing up in New Zealand and the Pacific, and thinking about children's experiences in different ethnic communities, faith communities, levels of poverty, different kinds of stress. And I was originally commissioned to do the work for the Electoral Commission because they wanted to know why kids weren't voting. You know, we wanted to say to them, give them something to vote for, and they will. But you know, but what was fascinating to me was that the interventions around things like, for instance, Indigenous language programs for Māori had very large spillover effects for the environment because of my interest in environment, in very positive ways that weren't being picked up under the radar. This question about the depoliticisation and what active listening might be, I'll come back to the rest of what you were just asking, Tara, but it was Britain that I picked up that idea about the active keynote listener as a policy role. And that's one small thing that we've done in New Zealand in the wake of the quakes that's made an enormous difference, is that politicians and public policy analysts come along to forums as an active keynote listener. They're not talking, they're just listening. And then they're responding back to what they got from it. It's a tiny little thing. It's like commissioners, it's like any opportunity to set up a long view in policy making, it makes a big difference. And it's a small intervention, and I am surprised about the difference it can make. It's not really, it's only a tip of the bigger question. About thinking about different groups of kids, coming back to this other question, one of the things that has disturbed me, and I picked up this phrase from when we were talking about how we might classify these groups of children that are growing up at the moment across the world, but there's one distinct group of the neoliberal self-help that Joel Westheim has called the No Generation Left Thinking, but the self-helpers have got a disturbingly authoritarian tendency, and I think that's something that we need to think through. And there's certainly a big push in disaster recovery to consolidate, to get people to act in certain ways. Bonnie Honoig has written some beautiful work, the philosopher, around thinking about disasters and environmental change within a context of life rather than as exceptionalism. Because if you think of it as exceptionalism, you get to do all sorts of stuff like we've done at home, suspend the democracy, suspend constitutions. So how do you think about citizenship on a range of issues? Other kids that I've really fallen in love with and worried about are the eco-warriors, the kids who know everything and feel really desperate about it. And the streetwide skeptics and those kids that are really tough, they fascinate me, but they have got a whole separate set of challenges. And that's what I'm loving about working here. It's been so creative to work at Resolve around it. So thanks.
Great. Anyone else want to respond? Yes.
Hi, I'm Rachel Howell from the University of Edinburgh. My question is for Alexia about the transition movement. A friend of mine who set up the City of Sanctuary movement, which is about making cities more welcoming to asylum seekers, is somewhat worried about what he sees as the self-sufficiency kind of strand in the transition movement. He's concerned that he likes the whole localization thing and all of that, but he's concerned that there might be a kind of pulling up the ladder thing in some of those groups, that people are kind of got this strong sense of, we are going to make our own community resilient and strong, and you know, we'll be all right when peak oil hits, and we are providing our own food and we are generating our own energy. And he's concerned that that might actually lead to those communities being less welcoming to climate refugees. And that actually we can't just sort of go for self-sufficiency and localization in a world in which the problems will be globalized and we will see far more climate refugees. Would you say that's a fair criticism from what you know of the transition movement or not?
Okay. Yes.
In the discussion about both reduction and sort of fairness of reducing carbon, how much has that been tested against the scale of reduction that the government is committed to, 80% by 2050, or if we exclude freight, 95% by 2050? My concern is that people are looking at reducing by 5 or 10% and feeling stressed by it, but aren't actually taking on board what's really facing them.
And we'll get someone in the back, because I've had a terrible bias for the front. That woman is a woman. Do you see her, Gemma, back there? Yeah. Oh, there's another.
I'm wondering if we can, thanks to all of you for great talks, I'm wondering if we can integrate a little bit of what Bronwyn was saying into some of these other talks, particularly around depoliticization, the dangers of getting too much depoliticization, particularly what you were saying earlier, Michael, about engaging with sort of local authorities. So like how is it that, in terms of, if any of the panelists have some ideas around really sort of engaging the government, engaging the local authorities, particularly at the local community level, since that's where most of you are working, and at the same time having a really strong political stance, and like how do those things sort of do or don't work together, particularly with young people?
So why don't we start with those?
Starting with your question, Rachel. Among the groups that I've, or the people that I've met in groups, I don't have that sense that it's about drawing up ladders. I think it's more about saying, let's relocalize as much as we can in terms of local food production. I don't have that sense that that is what it's about. Having said that, there have been some blogs, blogging around survivalism, and I think there are certainly probably some individuals who are involved who have a more, concerned about, but often more at a household level, I think, about protecting our particular sphere and our particular element. I think it's probably a better question to actually address to Rob, but I don't feel it's been actively debated, and that's where I think the weakness maybe is, that perhaps there is discussion, I think, at some of the conferences. Often social justice issues will come up, less around perhaps future climate refugees, but around issues around social justice, and that often comes up at conferences as a particular topic. But the Transition Network per se hasn't really perhaps promoted that as a debate, I would say. And so I can understand some concerns from people outside the movement. I haven't seen it within, from those that I've talked to.
Yeah, I can make a couple of comments on the scale of the targets and also something on the local authority. I think that one of the big shortcomings from both state and non-state community engagement interventions and initiatives projects up until now is that many of them haven't had a rigorous measurement process, evaluation process embedded within them right from the outset. And if we are able to assess properly and in much more tangible ways the amount of progress that they are enabling within communities or by individuals in terms of the levels of reduction and what therefore is possible, then that's an important step that needs to be taken for future initiatives. So it's definitely a shortcoming. Engaging local authorities is a difficult challenge, and what you tend to find, what we've found so far, is that you have a relatively small number of best practice case studies who have really taken the bull by the horns and developed climate change agendas as a key strategy for what they're about, how they identify themselves, and trying to lead the way. That is often a result of having one particular person, whether it's the chief executive officer or somebody relatively senior in the authority itself, taking the lead and pushing it through. And it doesn't help now that we had the performance indicators for measuring the impact and the progress of local authorities in reducing climate or reducing greenhouse gas emissions within their jurisdictions taken away, a recently established set of performance indicators that no longer exist, and we're not quite sure what they're going to be replaced by. So it's not really an answer to the question, but it's just to say it's difficult Maybe some of the good practice, but also some of the worst practice, needs to be highlighted more effectively. If I could just say, these are all issues which are contained and looked at from different perspectives within a book called Low Carbon Communities that draws on work from across Resolve's research strands that we had published at the end of last year. I'll just stick a picture of it up on the thing for you. It's available in all good bookshops.
Chris, did you want to answer the question about the magnitude of targets?
Yeah. I'd agree with Michael in that it's certainly something that needs to be looked at more within community schemes and the scale of achievements. With regard to households specifically, on an individual basis, I would say yes, they are fretting over the 5-10% reductions. And I would say certainly from this study, there's a definite sense of being unsure, that question, that statement of how much is enough. They are very much operating in the 10% realm at the moment, and would like to. I'm unsure of where the end is really. Where is the finishing point for them? And some are coming. Although in Resolve we take this sort of consumption-based perspective, when you flip that round and you go into the households, showing them their carbon emissions attributable to that, you then get into discussions of, well, am I truly responsible for that? There's a debate that goes on there as to, well, how much do I need to reduce by, because I'm not sure I'm really, truthfully responsible for that from my perspective. So there's a bit of a balancing act there, if that adds.
Yes.
Hi, thanks for all your very interesting contributions. My name's Anna Foxall from Gramat UK. Everything is of interest to me, but particularly I manage a big lottery fund programme called Community Spaces, and that is £57.5 million that we give out to community groups. So far, 883,000 community members have benefited from this programme, and I'm just interested as to your thoughts as to, there are people out there who want to make a difference, who are making a difference, but there is a cost associated with people trying to do this. It's not, nothing happens for free. Even the transition cities, it all costs money. And whilst this programme is only open to community groups to apply to, they have to work with other organisations like their local authorities, their parish councils, or groundwork trusts. So whilst the desire to make these changes is out there with people, there is money that needs to be made available. So what are your thoughts and findings on that?
Thank you. I'm Liz Dowler from the University of Warwick, and thank you for all the presentations, as has been said. I just wanted to kind of pick up, really, on both presentations and some of the previous comments, and it certainly follows even from the last one, which is that, forgive me if I'm making an obvious point, people's thinking, people's values, people's sense of fairness is not fixed in time, and these are processes, if you like, if that's the best word. But these are works in progress. Perhaps that's a better way of putting it. My own work is more to do with food and the ways in which people engage in different aspects of the food system, particularly local foods and so on. And one of the things that's come out of that research is how much people can give you with effort. It's not an easy thing to articulate. A sense of trajectory, a sense of change, and how they think and feel and therefore act, or possibly how they act and therefore how they think and feel. I mean, I was very taken by your point about citizenship being about doing, and thus you change your thinking. I don't know, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know which direction these things go in, but there is a danger in thinking that people's views are where you start and that then leads to change in behaviour. Often it's the other way around. And certainly that's been my experience for people getting involved in different kinds of food projects, for instance, and particularly in talking about fairness and what that means. Fairness for the individual, fairness for my family, fairness for my neighbourhood, fairness for my community, whatever that community is, larger or smaller. So I suppose that poses methodological challenges for research and also poses kind of optimism, possibilities for policy, because you don't just have to go out by beating everybody on the head or setting targets. These all have parts to play, but they clearly are only part of the repertoire. And just to kind of, just two quick additional points to make on that. In some of the other sessions, I think, where people are talking about what happens if you expend less carbon and gain more money, and I think Julia mentioned this too earlier this morning, and the only two possibilities in the model are that you spend more or you save more of the income that you have thereby gained. But of course, what you could also do is give that income away, and this doesn't seem to appear in the model. Redistribution could be part of the response of not spending money. Because what it seems to me some of the new, the low-carbon initiatives are about are redistributing time, redistributing labour effort into doing things differently. And we can also redistribute money if the state won't enable us to do that through taxes. We can have an argument about that, whether they indirect or direct taxation. But if the state doesn't do that, there are other ways of giving away money, as well as giving away time and effort and skill, which is very much what transition is about.
I'm going to actually maybe let someone else do the third question. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. My name is Hetty Einzig. I'm from Be the Change. I'm pausing because there was so much richness. Thank you all very much. Very, very rich. And I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to link a couple of ideas and ask a question. A lot of this debate reminds me, I used to run something called the Parenting Forum, now Parenting UK, and there was a lot of pressure to call it Parents. And it was in the early days when we were trying to get parents on the map as opposed to just sort of angels and demons and all the emphasis was on children. And so we called it parenting, much against our, you know, it doesn't sound very euphonic, but to put the emphasis on process and that it's a job that we all engage in, which I think now has kind of entered the debate. And something that really struck me is the sort of separateness, the silo thinking that still pertains in this debate. First of all, sustainability is a deeply unsexy concept. You know, it just is not attractive. I'm a mother of two teenagers and I'm exactly living what you've been describing, Bronwyn. And my younger daughter is engaged in UK Uncut, which is exciting. You know, we forget how exciting it is to be political and to demonstrate. But equally, she's involved in a very long-term project at Heathrow, which is the reclamation of some damaged, completely, you know, destroyed, abandoned greenhouses, which have been lovingly and painstakingly resurrected to grow food. And these young people, some of them as young as 15, have engaged the local community in this village of Sibson, many of whom are in their 80s, and they made a little film about it. I burst into tears. It was that moving and that incredible that these young people do not make a division between green and politics. And one of the platforms of Be the Change is this interdependence between social justice issues, whether it's politics, green issues, and personal fulfillment. And we don't just make an independent, they have to go together, because if we keep talking about low-carbon communities, I mean, forgive me, I'm sure it's a great book, but it isn't going to be up there with the bestsellers at the airport. We have to make this, we have to tell an exciting story for the future rather than keep on pushing this denial and abnegation thing. And I want to pick up something that Chris mentioned when you interviewed your householders. That last quote, you know, how ashamed we should be. And I'd like to ask any of the panelists who care to respond, which are the kind of energetic. I'm a psychotherapist by training and very interested in psychology of the whole thing. What are the drivers for change? Is shame a good driver for change? Is anger a good driver for change? Is excitement? What are the drivers for change that we should be building on rather than looking backwards? And I don't think the policymakers are going to act fast enough. I think it's got to happen in local communities and with our young people. Sorry, a bit of a rant, but there is a question in there. Thank you.
I can't remember where we started now. What was the first question?
Nice.
Yes, okay. Money. These things all cost money. Does anyone want to take that on?
Okay. Yes. I mean, I think that that certainly is, I think, a challenge a lot of transition groups come up with, is where do we... there will be not often quite small pots of money that need to start a sort of initiative. But I've also come across groups who've actually been, once they've got a bit of money, actually said that it can be a bit of a struggle to know how to spend it. So it's also, it's about flexibility. And I think another challenge, I think, for a lot of, I mean, again, this wasn't the kind of focus of my research, but a lot of the interviews that I did came up with the issue about time and commitment and energy, and how this is often having to be done in sort of spare moments around other kind of commitments, which can be very exhausting. And again, I think Transition Network's been putting quite a lot of effort in trying to think about and support groups to know what their levels of commitment can be without sort of burning out. So burnout is a common problem for them, as with a vast array of community groups. But I think what's also interesting about transition, and again, I think we may well talk about this later, is that I think beginning to look at alternative forms of investment rather than grant funding. So part of this idea of kind of setting up more of a social enterprise is around livelihoods, changing local systems, be it food systems, energy systems, etc. But it's also partly about generating sustainable income to keep things going. So I think what's quite interesting is that there is a beginning a shift. So I think a lot of groups do start sort of saying, well, maybe get a bit of money from the local council or from a small grant here. But they're beginning, in those that are better established, have been around for longer and doing perhaps more ambitious things, begin to think about more sustainable income rather than partly because of the changing economic climate.
So maybe I'll just, I wanted to answer say something about the second and third comments. On the question of giving money, which is a really important practice, both because it turns out to be extremely beneficial and empowering for the giver, and also because if you're giving to people who have significant need, it's helps them tremendously as well. So income redistribution or wealth redistribution, I think, is extremely important, but it's important to remember that from an ecological point of view, it's not necessarily footprint reducing, because, I mean, the point about income is if you spend it, it's eco-impact today. If you save it, it's also eco-impact today, because somebody else is investing it, unless you have a shrinking economic system. And if it's invested, it might be even more eco-impact in the future, depending, or less, depending on the technologies and what that investment is. So this is why I focused so much on scale of output, because as long as you keep putting demand into the system, whether it's savings or slash investment or consumption, that's footprint making, as it were. On the question of drivers for change, it's a really important. I started an environmental NGO in 1995, actually with whoever asked about the limits to growth, with Dana Meadows and a number of other people. It was very successful. One of the things that we did, totally in contrast to the rest of where the U.S. green or environmental movement was at that point, was we focused on the positive, on solutions. Guilt, shame, anger, denial, all of those things are terrible from the point of view of mobilization. And I think from the household's point of view, what's particularly important about why guilt is not a good motivator is that their scope of action is small. So you're making people feel guilty about something that, you know, for all the reasons that we've been talking about, they don't have 100% control over. Anger, of course, is motivating within an aspirational context. But if we think about all successful social movements, they are aspirational. They are built on the belief that they can change the world, because otherwise people are rational. There's no point in making these struggles unless we think we can actually, you know, have an impact. I think one of the great things about young people and their political activity is that they do have strong sense of effectiveness and ability to do things. And when they lose that, of course, that's when they stop.
No, they don't necessarily grow up. And I just, if I could just add, I mean, yes, obviously, one of the things that has been so moving to me about the earthquake experience is that actually the people who are the most helpful to us now are the people who can offer us something. Plan, not aid, I'm meaning ideas in practice from their experiences. And actually, when the everything hits the fan, and if this building collapsed and everything around you collapsed, I'll try not to get emotional. Actually, you know the people that are going to dig in and help, and you know how you're going to get out of it. And also, internationally, it is the aspiration, it's the plan B, it's the new economics, it's the new ways of thinking about the community. We are a really low-income community hit by a tragedy that we can't actually afford to get out of. And we're going to have to rethink lots of things. So we actually don't need, I'm a critical theorist, but we don't need critical theory at the moment. We need new plan Bs when plan A failed. And I think that aspiration and that offering something is fantastic.
Humans cannot live without food. And I've gone over my allotted time. And I think that particularly since I spent a long time this morning talking about how we shouldn't work so hard, it's time to socialize. And thanks to a wonderful panel.